And welcome to our newest member, Senator Haas. Nice to have you with us. We're going to make a slight change in the agenda. The presentation on the economic revenue forecast will follow our discussion and actions on the grant requests. So I'd like to move immediately into the federal grant requests consent items number 1 through 12. Could we have a brief summary from staff?
Yes. Co-chairs, members of the committee, Legislative Fiscal Office recommends the approval of 12 grant application requests with the understanding that if the grants are awarded, the agency will return to the Emergency Board or Legislative Assembly for approval of any necessary additional federal funds, expenditure limitation, and position authority. Number one, Department of Consumer and Business Services, approve retroactively the submission of a federal grant application to the U.S. Health and Human Services Department, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, in the amount of $3.9 million for an operational loss grant and bonus grant for supplemental consumer benefits. Number two, Department of Environmental Quality, approve retroactively the submission of a federal grant application to the Environmental Protection Agency in the amount of $1,248,667 for monitoring of the McCormick and Baxter Superfund cleanup site. Number three, Department of Environmental Quality, approve the submission of a federal grant application to the Environmental Protection Agency in the amount of $100,000 to help small businesses comply with new federal air quality standards. Number four, the Department of Human Services, approve retroactively the submission of a federal grant application to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and the National Center for Environmental Health in the amount of up to $750,000 over 5 years to gather data on harmful algal blooms. Number five, the Department of Human Services, approve retroactively the submission of a federal grant application to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Administration for Children and Families to up to $2 million over a five-year period to improve the recruitment of families for children in the foster care system. Number six, the Department of Human Services, approve retroactively the submission of a federal grant application to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Food and Nutrition Service in the amount of $497,211 for a two-year grant to improve the food stamp recertification application process and improve access to benefits. Number seven, the Department of Human Services, approve the submission of a federal grant application to U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services for up to $1.6 million for a three-year period to improve information and services for persons with disabilities or chronic illnesses who are discharged from the hospital. Number eight, Department of State Lands, approve retroactively the submission of a federal grant application to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in the amount of $267,350 for a two-year Bay Watershed Education and Training Program grant. Number nine, the Department of Transportation, approve retroactively the submission of a federal grant application to the U.S. Federal Highway Administration for a National Scenic Byway Discretionary Grant. Number 10, Department of Transportation, approve retroactively the submission of a federal grant application to the U.S. Department of Homeland Security for assistance in implementing new Oregon laws relating to the Real ID Act. Number 11, the Employment Department, approve retroactively the submission of a federal grant application to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services in the amount of $750,000 to study the use of child care subsidies. Number 12, Housing and Community Services Department, approve retroactively the submission of a federal grant application to the National Foreclosure Mitigation Program in the amount of $327,004 for foreclosure mitigation counseling. And that concludes the consent agenda.
Thank you. These are a consent agenda. Are there any items that members of the committee need to take off the consent agenda, which would allow for discussion? Seeing none, can I get a motion to approve them in
I move the consent agenda in block.
Senator Schrader moves approving the consent agenda in block. Any objections? Seeing none. So ordered. Thank you. We do have one grant application that has been separated out for discussion. As you see, the military department has a grant proposal that we are going to listen to specifically because it's got some material that we thought needed some discussion. Mr. Rocco? General Caldwell?
Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Just a minute, General Caldwell. Can we hear from staff first, and then we'll get the department's take on it.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we just separated this grant out just to get some more discussion about a couple of items of concern, not about the grant, but about its possible implementation. And so the military department is here to explain what this grant is about.
Okay, thanks. Please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell, the Deputy Director of the Military Department. With me today is Satish Pagi from the Department of Military Service, and Lieutenant Colonel Thompson, Chaplain Thompson, who's also in charge of our reintegration team for the Oregon National Guard. The military department is seeking retroactive legislative approval to apply for this federal grant from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. This grant is titled Grant to Expand Substance Abuse Treatment Capacity in Targeted Areas of Need. And its goal is to help reduce the devastating impact of chemical dependency for individual, family, and community at the community level. It will be used by the department mainly to assist National Guard members who are affected by alcohol and drug abuse, as well as their families. The target population of this grant will be veterans from age 18 and over. According to the combined data we've been collecting from 2004 to 2006, an average of about 7% of the veterans have experienced a mental health disorder in the past year. In addition, veterans aged 18 to 25 are more likely to suffer from a mental health disorder than their counterparts in that age group. Also, according to the data that's been collected by the federal government, 25% of the veterans in this same 18 to 25 age group met the criteria for substance abuse disorder. And along with that, 11.3% of the veterans in the age group from 26 to 54 also fell into that category. The priority of this grant, and the reason we request it, will be to help military families in northeastern Oregon and the Umatilla County area, mainly due to the size of the grant. But the program will also be open to others who suffer from trauma. We can't exclude regular citizens from attending or from seeking this service. We're hoping that the Umatilla County area, and particularly the Oregon National Guardsmen who have been impacted in that area, we've had over 200 deployments from that particular Tri-County area, people who have deployed. We're hoping that this service will be available to, if it is available, we'll get our guardsmen and their families to avail themselves to that service. Part of the stigma that happens with soldiers when they return from combat and they have these different problems is that they do not seek, because they're still in the service, they do not seek traditional methods that perhaps a veteran normally would, which would be through the Department of Defense or through the Department of Veterans Administration. There's a Veterans Administration office in Walla Walla. We've tried to move a lot of our people to that for this kind of care, but that doesn't necessarily take care of the families, nor do soldiers who are continuing to serve want to get involved in that, for they're fearful for their perhaps a retribution coming from their command or coming from the service if they're found to have some PTSD or some other issue. So this looks like a great opportunity for us to open up another avenue, see how it went, see if we could get families and soldiers into that where it's non-attributional. We won't recommend people to it. We won't send people to it. We'll just make it available, put the information out to our soldiers and their families so they can seek this service at no cost to them. And therefore, they don't have to get into TRICARE. They don't have to come to us. They don't have to look for money. They can just go get this service. And we're hoping that will avail them to more service to help them in the things that they need to be helped with. We wished it was more money. We wish we could do it statewide. In our conversations with the federal government, if this works well, we're hoping that they will give us more dollars to do this statewide. That concludes my testimony. Chaplain Thompson will answer any questions that you may have, or, of course, Satish can do the same.
Okay. Let's briefly hear from Department of Administrative Services.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. This is Satish Upadhyay with the Department of Administrative Services. We are recommending that you approve this request.
Okay. Great. Mr. Rocco, did you want to briefly outline the issues you wanted to highlight?
Yes, Madam Chair and members of the committee, ELPA also recommends approving the request. We did note some, in our analysis, some concerns about the risk for soldiers considering voluntary treatment of this kind and whether they are ultimately found to be fit to serve if they seek this kind of a treatment. And just based on those, we just wanted to point out that we have some concerns about how the programs can be implemented by the military department to effectively provide this service to returning soldiers. And we would just like the agency to come back and report to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means during its budget hearings next session about how this program was implemented, if the grant award is successful.
Okay. Any questions or discussion from committee members? Senator Verger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. General Colwell, I guess that what I would like, if you could, to please briefly explain to me a little bit about the responsibility that the federal government looks at overall. I know that this is a grant proposal for one small area, but I think that what I would like to do, particularly with Memorial Day so recent in the background with me, that I'd like to just hear you tell me what is the attitude and position of the federal government as to the responsibility of this problem.
Madam Chair, Senator Verger, I think as we look back in the last, seems like forever now, but it's been 6-7 years since we started deploying soldiers on a fairly regular basis, the federal government, I think, was very slow to react to the impacts of those deployments, and that included everything from the initial deployment to the train up, to the deployment in the country, and even coming home, how the people were demobilized and taken care of. I will tell you that I think in the last 3 years there has been a monumental shift in attitudes. There's been a tremendous amount of Congress has pushed a tremendous amount of dollars toward the VA, particularly to address this issue. I just got an email this week where finally they're taking clients now, and they're having a ribbon cutting in a new VA clinic in LaGrande, which is a step forward. There's a VA clinic in Bend, and one in Medford. There's been a lot of outreach going on that wasn't there 5 years ago, 4 years ago, even 3 years ago. So we're starting to see, I think, a very positive change in events. The National Guard Bureau just this year started funding additional positions for us, for our reintegration team, which we didn't have before. We were before this body. This body pretty much supported it 100%. The legislature supported our reintegration efforts pretty much 100%. Now the National Guard Bureau, at the behest of Congress, at the order of Congress, has established a program for every state in the union to do similar to what we were doing. We were one of the first ones, if not the first ones, to do that. So I think what we've seen is a positive movement toward this back end. Does that mean it's done? No. I would suggest that there's a tremendous amount left to be done. I think we're continuing to suggest to the National Guard Bureau and to our federal delegation what we think needs to happen and what we think needs to occur, particularly after soldiers return from Iraq or Afghanistan. The best example I could give you is we're having a demobilization ceremony tomorrow, I believe it is, for the 224th engineers in Albany. They actually landed in Fort Hood, Texas, I believe, Tuesday. So now they're going to come home, so that would be Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, 5. We're going to have 6, maybe 7 days total and then returning them back into the community. We're very opposed to that. We've argued this point. We've told folks that we need to keep these people longer because we don't mean they need to go home, but we need to keep an eye on them. We need to make them come back. Some of them may have jobs, be just fine, but we need to have that reintegration process take some steps. That is a big gap that needs to be addressed. I think by and large, from the VA standpoint, it's gotten considerably better. I won't say they're 100% yet, but they're considerably better than they were. And I think it's a credit to them, particularly in this region. I'm not sure you'll find that everywhere in the United States, but I think in this region, they've taken this thing extremely seriously. Our reintegration process, where we have our 6 month, every 6 months we have a summit. The governor's got a task force put together. We're engaging these people on a weekly basis, and sometimes on a daily basis. And they're really leaning forward, and I think we're starting to get some real traction there. So I would give it a B-plus at this point if I was grading it.
A follow-up, Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that, and that's good news. I'm glad to hear that, because we certainly have had some struggles in the past, and to be moving forward. And I think today being D-Day, yeah, June the 6th, I think that following Memorial Day, there's a lot of focus and a lot of attention on what the people do who serve our country. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I couldn't glean this from the written summary or from your testimony. Is this a program that you're starting from scratch? You say that you're going to be contracting with private entities for residential beds. Is the theory that this is military doing for military rather than just putting the money through already established channels or already established operations? I missed that nuance, if you said it.
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, in essence, it is going to be open to the general population. Of the state. The emphasis is going to be on military families and military members. The best way that we think that we can make that happen is to make sure that the people in that area, that Tri-County area, understand that the service is available, particularly the family program. And there is no specifically, you have to show your ID card to get into this program.
Madam Chair, I asked my question incorrectly.
Follow up.
I'm trying to figure out if there's an established provider so that you don't have to start from scratch to create a program, or if there was something already in situ that was working splendidly, if you could just funnel the money through an existing operation.
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, excuse me, yes, indeed, this is an established operation in the Umatilla County area, which is one of the reasons why we picked it, was
cool.
Because it is up and running, operating. There isn't a ramp up. You've got to build the staff, got to build this, build that.
That answers my question.
Just adding little capacity is all we're doing.
Thank you.
Excellent. Representative Shields.
Senator Johnson,
that's
my question.
Great. Senator Wardley.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Good morning, General. Appreciating what you've said about the availability of services and that there has been improvement, would you tell us what is the wait, though, for returnees and their family members who need services now?
Madam Chairman and Senator Gordon, there are some wait. The issue is really not a wait for help. The issue really for us and concerned is the fact that sometimes our soldiers don't want to go through the VA and through the official channels because they're trying to protect their Guard career. Understand that the dynamic being a lot of the soldiers, you know, have struggled with planning for retirement, and they've got one thing going. Most of us have put quite a bit of time on active duty, and so we've got a few years of active duty time, and so all that counts toward our future plans. And so we jump into the Guard and we plan on serving part time, but we value holding on to that time and that training that we have, and obviously love serving the country. And so it's always a concern for the guardsman to make sure that his career stays intact and to see that to completion. And so for a lot of them, there's a concern, well, if I find out that I need this treatment or if I have issues going on, then that's going to affect my progress. And so a lot of us have invested a lot of time, and so it's we're providing other options for them so that they can get the help. We want them to have the help. We do not punish them for getting the help. But that is a perception that we deal with soldiers.
I think the answer to your question, though, is there is some delays with respect to treatment at the Veterans Administration. However, all veterans who are Iraqi or Afghanistan veterans are the priority. So they get priority over all other veterans.
Yeah.
So when they show up and they say, here's my 214, this is where I served, they go to the front of the line.
Mm-hmm.
We heard a testimony yesterday from a veteran who, in the governor's veterans task force, who until 5 years ago had used nothing but, you know, the traditional commercial care services that are out there, Blue Cross, Blue Shield. 5 years ago, for some unknown reason, he stumbled into the Veterans Affairs up in Portland Veterans Hospital, and he says, you know what, it is the best care I've ever gotten.
Mm-hmm.
And he testified, you know, vehemently that I've never gotten better treatment than I'm getting now. So I think the VA has had a stigma. There's no question about that. And the stigma started with the Vietnam veterans. And most of the people that they're seeing today are Vietnam-era veterans. They're not Iraqi or Afghanistan veterans. And some of that is because of the war has rekindled those issues, and those people are showing up. However, if an Iraqi or Afghanistan veteran shows up, they go to the front line.
Mm-hmm.
Before we go any further, I have to back up a little bit, sir, and if you wouldn't mind stating your name so that our audio record has it.
Excuse me, ma'am. I am Chaplain Daniel Thompson. I'm Deputy Director of the Reintegration Team, Oregon Army National Guard.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Senator Schrader?
Yes, ma'am. I'd like to approve the request with the instructions.
Senator Schrader moves approving this request with the instructions that Mr. Rocco has outlined. Any objections? Seeing none. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
See you later in the month.
Thank you. Okay, let's back up to the economic and revenue forecast. In a guest appearance, Mr. Steve Bender will be summarizing this information for us. Mr. Patowski? Oh, excuse me. Mr. Bender.
Madam Chair, if I could just explain for the committee, we had intended to have the Office of Economic Analysis make this presentation. However, there seems to have been a communication breakdown, and they are unable to do this. So Mr. Bender has agreed under duress to go ahead and summarize what he knows about the forecast, since he does follow this fairly closely. And we have provided in your packets the summary document that was provided by OEA when they presented this to the revenue committees last week.
And in particular, members of the committee, Senator Schrader and I wanted this item on our agenda because it is so pertinent to actions that this committee needs to follow, that having a little bit of discussion and presentation about it as background we thought would be very helpful. Mr. Bender.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair and members. I am Steve Bender from the Legislative Fiscal Office, and I do hope you will understand that I intend to present a very brief and high-level overview of the forecast. I certainly do not have the information and knowledge about this that the state economist does, and I don't want to say anything that's wrong, so it's better to say as little as possible so I can be sure that things that I'm saying are correct. But the new forecast was released about a week or so ago, and this is the June quarterly forecast. As you know, the forecast is revised on a quarterly basis, and this is the one, this is the first forecast to come out since the forecast was released in February during the February supplemental session. The forecast always contains two major components, a economic forecast and a revenue forecast. I'll talk briefly about the economic forecast and then a little more in depth about the revenue forecast. The economic forecast, in particular, compared to the forecast that was released in February, is weaker than the February forecast. That is to say, the projections for the both the national and Oregon economies are not as robust as had been the case in February. In a nutshell, the major difference is that the extent of the economic slowdown in terms of time, more so than in terms of depth, but in terms of time and how long it will take for the economy to recover, has been extended in this forecast. And the forecast now assumes that we're really not going to get back into a period of more robust growth until the latter part of calendar year 2009. So essentially, under this forecast, throughout the entire meeting of the 2009 legislative session, the economy would not really have turned around quite yet. It would just be anticipating that return to growth would occur in the latter half of 2009. The concerns primarily continue to be the housing market, the state of the housing market, which continues to be weak in many parts of the country, pretty much everywhere to different degrees, the impact of rising energy prices on the economy, and factors that will take some time to work through. The state economist contracts with Global Insights, a consulting firm for a national economic forecast, and the Global Insights forecast is actually forecasting a recession for the first half of 2008. The first half of 2008 is almost over, so according to Global Insights, they are assuming that we are in a recession now, which would indicate that output is actually declining. Typically, you don't know whether you're in a recession or when you're out of recession until after it's over, because there's a delay in getting the data. But we have not actually seen reported data that has been showing a decline in output. So in this sense, the Global Insights forecasting is showing something that hasn't become apparent yet, or is based on something that hasn't quite become apparent yet. But in the state economist spent considerable time in their presentation on the economic forecast talking about the last two recessions that hit the United States and the relative depth of those recessions in Oregon compared to the nation as a whole. The prior two recessions to hit the United States were in 1991 and in 2001. And the impacts on Oregon were quite different in those two recessions. In 1991, Oregon fared quite well compared to the rest of the country, and we experienced less economic distress than was generally the case in the country. In 2001, the opposite occurred, and the recession here was much steeper and more severe than it was typically in the rest of the country. They have attempted to try to project which of these two scenarios, if either of them, are more likely to occur this time around. And it is under their analysis, they do believe that this recession, if it is a recession, or slowdown, if it's not quite a recession, will be more like 1991 in the sense that Oregon's situation would be less adversely impacted than is typically the case. And the primary reason for that conclusion is the impact of the housing markets on the recession. This is a major cause of the slowdown in economic growth nationally, and the housing markets are not projected to fare as poorly under their projections, the state economist projections in Oregon, as they are typically throughout the country. That has certainly been the case so far, and this forecast is predicated on a prediction that will continue to be the case. In other words, that Oregon housing prices will, in their decline, will not catch up to the declines that we've seen in some of the other parts of the country. If there aren't any specific questions about the economic forecast, I'd like to move on to the revenue forecast, which, of course, is affected by the economic forecast. But you have a material...
I'm sorry, Mr. Bender. Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you, Chair Nolan. Mr. Bender, I was particularly concerned about, I thought, what some of the things that I thought might have been left out of the forecast and some of the things that may have been understated in the forecast. To begin with, the unemployment levels I know have been restated, but in the five counties that I represent are averaging just at 10%, ranging from 11.5 on down. The housing market, in particularly in Deschutes and Jackson counties, are collapsing. Values are going down. Many people do not have have negative equity in their homes now. The short sales and I believe there's 200 short sales and foreclosures currently on the books in Klamath County alone. And then the other thing, and there was just a brief mention here of the credit problems, but I think that, again, was greatly understated. In my opinion, the mortgage foreclosures and the junk bond failures have been greatly understated. I think in August, there was something like $42 trillion of unsecured credit debt swaps in the United States. And according to the Wall Street Journal last month, those unsecured debt swaps had increased to $63 trillion. So I think one of the reasons I looked into that a little closer, and I won't bore you with all the details, but I mean, when you see President George Bush and Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi sharing the podium holding hands, that gave me a reason to look further. And certainly there is appears to be a major credit debacle out there. So specifically, could you talk a little bit more about the mortgage problems in Oregon, the drops in the regional drop in house pricing, the regional escalation in unemployment, and also on the a little more about the credit debt swaps and the leverage on the unholy leverage on those things.
Thank you, Senator. I can address some of your questions, and others I will try to have the state economists get back to you with responses. But clearly, one thing that I did not cover in my very brief overview was a discussion of the forecast risks to the economic forecast. And as you point out, the situations in the in the housing and mortgage and credit markets are of concern, and they are highlighted as a forecast risk, in the sense that if the situation in housing or the credit markets take longer to resolve or are more serious than is projected here, that could have a serious impact on the economic forecast and indeed the revenue forecast. That is identified as a risk, and I think it needs to be understood that the total extent of the clearly forecasting housing prices is just a forecast, and we can't be certain as to what will happen. A turnaround in the national economy will probably require a stabilization of housing prices overall, at least on the national level, before that turnaround can start to occur. So to the extent that if prices continue to fall, this would could deepen the recession or delay the recovery even further. So you are correct to be worried about those particular factors. However, again, in the actual forecast, the assumption is that by the second half of 2009, these issues would pretty much have worked their way through, and that the housing market would be back stable again in terms of prices and supply and demand overall. In terms of regional issues, I do not have specific information on the regional sectors here and the impact on, you know, the forecast is not specifically done for there are no separate forecasts done for the different regions of the state, though I'm sure the state economist would have significant information on the regional situation. I can say that the forecast at a statewide level is predicated on there not being the situation that you're seeing in your area in terms of housing prices occurring statewide. If that were to be the case, I'm sure that these forecasted numbers would be lower than they are in terms of both economic activity and revenues. So it is the forecast assumes that your situation, the situation in the parts of the state, and as you mentioned, Deschutes County is having a very difficult time in that area in terms of housing prices, that these would not be this extent of market distress will not spread through the rest of the state.
That's a pretty big bet, Senator, and it's a good thing that we pay attention to it. Mr. Bender? Oh. Representative Galizio, question on the economic forecast?
Yeah, actually two observations and a question. So one, in the housing market, I don't know what constitutes a collapse, how you define a collapse, but the percentage increase in the housing values that led up to this collapse, I don't know what those figures are, but I think they're pretty substantial increases we saw in terms of the housing value. So they're certainly leveling out, and there's definitely a problem, but I think it's maybe premature to call it a collapse, even in some of these areas. But secondly, it's to be an economist is such an amazing job, because I heard you say that there's no data for a decline in output that we had. So there's a claim being made without evidence. So what a fascinating a job to be an economist. My question is, was there any, and I'm not saying you, but my question is, was there any discussion about, in terms of in-migration, in other words, Oregon, for the past number of years, we've had greater in-migration than out-migration, and that perhaps impacts the economy and housing and in various other ways. Is there any indication or evidence or predictions that in-migration will be slowing or fewer people are going to be moving to Oregon?
I'm trying to check here on some of the materials that I have. I don't have the answer to your question, and I'll see if I can find it very quickly, and if I can't, again, we'll have to get back to you on that. I apologize. But my memory is that there was not projected to be a major impact on rates of in-migration because of the short-term economic situation, but I will get back to you on that.
Anybody else on the economic part of the forecast? Let's move on to revenue.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I believe we do have a handout here on the summary document, and I would ask you to turn to page 11 of that handout, because page 11 has the general fund forecast. And the general fund forecast, as you may know, is generally divided into three broad categories: the personal income tax forecast, the corporate income tax forecast, and then everything else. And if you look at the table on page 11, in the column that is the second from the right, which is the change from the last forecast, even though it was released in February, it's technically the March forecast, you can see that the impact on changes projected for the current biennium, of which we are approximately now halfway through. Personal income tax revenues are up $111 million over what was projected for you during your supplemental session. Corporate income tax revenues are $50 million below projections, and everything else includes things such as interest earnings, liquor apportionment, all the other items that go into the general fund. They are projected to be $30 million higher than it was the case 3 months ago, for a total change of $91.2 million. So the revenue forecast is actually up for general fund by $91.2 million. Most of that is in the personal income tax component, which is by far the largest component of the general fund. But the interesting thing to note about this particular increase is that this increase is primarily due to the fact that since the March forecast, the income tax collection season is over. People were, of course, required to file generally by April 15th, and we now know what the income tax collections actually were. It's always very difficult to project what the end of tax year collections will be. And it turns out that for personal income tax, the amount of final payments were $178 million greater than the amount that was projected for the period of this tax year to date. So from January through May, final payments, which are what people who owe tax send in with their state tax return as opposed to getting a tax a refund, were $178 million higher, which is quite astounding, actually, to have that large an increase. And upon review, it was the state economist's analysis that the increase was due primarily to capital gains income that was not anticipated. And given the volatility of capital gains income from one year to another, it would be perhaps unwise to assume that this level would be continuing on an ongoing basis. So of the these final payments were $178 million higher than anticipated. The total collections were $110 million higher than anticipated. So there were other offsetting factors. Withholding was less than anticipated, and tax refunds were greater than anticipated. So that reduced the increase down to $110.9 million. But again, because this is almost exclusively due to capital gains income that was being realized, which is a very volatile tax source, it would be of concern that this does not represent a ongoing increase in the level of revenues. There were also some other impacts to general fund resources that you can see. I'll go back to page 11. If you look below, if we're still in the third column, or the second column from the right, and if you look below the $91.2 million, you can see that there are other items that are indicating that the state will have more funds available in the general fund than was anticipated 3 months ago. These include administrative actions of $15.2 million, which deal with cash management and interest earning and interest costs of cash management. Plus, I'm going to ask Mr. Rocco to confirm, I believe that $7.7 million was a reduction in expenditure, general fund expenditures during the supplemental session. So you reduce general fund expenditures by $7.7 million, which means that there will be an extra $114.2 million in the general fund ending balance compared to what was projected in February, leaving an ending balance of $143 million. On page 12 of your handout, you can see projections of both the Rainy Day Fund and the Education Stability Fund based on this current forecast. The current projections are that in 2007-09, the Rainy Day Fund will have an ending balance of $340.9 million, and the Education Stability Fund balance at the end of the biennium will be $396 million. Before going on to the lottery forecast, I would like to speak briefly about 09-11, which, of course, is the biennium that you will be budgeting for when you are in 2009 regular session. I don't believe that there's anything in your handout there that talks about 09-11, but some of the information that I can give you about that is that the change in the forecast for 09-11 is about as flat as as you can get compared to what was the projection in March, in the March forecast. That is to say, the combined general fund revenues that you would have available to you are up $8.6 million from what they were 3 months ago, which is, given the level of revenues, that's flat. So there is no change in the projected revenues for 2009-11 from the March forecast. If there are any aren't any questions, I'll talk briefly about lottery.
I think it's, if I may, just...
Senator.
I mean, I'm sure everyone here gets it, but just for the record, I think it's important for us to understand that the revenue forecast really isn't up. You know, one person made a difference in this revenue forecast, and it's not going to carry over until 2009-11. So that's the real point. And I think we have to make sure as we talk to our friends and partners in agency and education world that they understand that.
Well, and Mr. Co-Chair, members, particularly, we have so far not yet talked about the expenditure side of what we're looking at forward. And while Mr. Bender has suggested that the economists are predicting essentially a flat revenue forecast for 2009-11, the services that the legislature has approved to be delivered will cost more to deliver in 2009-11, and so we will have some opportunities to exercise our wisdom come January. Representative Morgan.
Thank you. Mr. Bender, first of all, let me just state for the record that in all the years I've known you, I've never seen you behave like an economist, so just to clear that there. The question that I have is, I think we're all pretty well aware that the increase in collections in the personal income tax are due to the capital gains that were paid by Mr. Knight in his stock sales. Is it possible to back out whatever that number is so that we can see what happened to the revenue projections absent that capital gains infusion?
First, I'd like to clarify that we do not have any information on any particular tax returns. That information is confidential, and we really would not have access to how much any individual taxpayer owed or paid or what their taxes were. I believe that the Office of Economic Analysis, however, does have information on the component of collections that are due or the proportion of collections that are due to taxes based on capital gains that were being declared. And certainly they could provide you with information on what the collections would have been, for example, if capital gains were at some other level, such as either a long-term average of what they are, certainly, or even if they were zero, even though we wouldn't typically expect to have no capital gains in the state. But that is information I'm sorry I don't have for you, but certainly that analysis of that type is available.
Can I have a follow-up, Ms.
Representative? Historically, this revenue forecast is the most volatile revenue forecast of the ones that we get throughout the year because of the tax receipts being reconciled as part of this forecast. And I think that as we go forward with the discussion around the ending balance, which is, I imagine, where we're going to end up talking as we go forward with the discussions on awarding the salary increase money or not, that it would be helpful to this panel if we could get a picture of what the revenue forecast looks like with this windfall capital gains being taken out of it. I think that would give us a better bead on where we're headed than trying to just look around this windfall that we've gotten. So I'm hopeful that we could get some kind of information generated from the revenue office that would help clarify that for us, because I think that that would help us if we knew how much of the ending fund balance was attributable to this one-time thing and how much of it or what it would look like without this one-time infusion. And I think that would give us a better picture of where we're trying to plan towards.
that's helpful. And I noted staff was making notes, so we'll make sure we get information available to members of the committee on that issue and others that come up during our discussion.
I do want to, if I may just clarify a couple things regarding Representative Morgan's question. I do believe that the forecast, the impact of what you are discussing, of correcting for or adjusting for the situation that you're talking about would have an impact in 07-09, the biennium we're currently in. But again, the forecast that you have before you is not predicated on a similar types of capital gains realizations in 09-11. And that is why, I think, or one of the reasons why, there's essentially no change in the 09-11 forecast for March, even though we see this change in 07-09. The other thing I wanted to clarify that may be confusing, and I apologize for this, is when I indicate that, when I said that there's really no change in 09-07 from the March forecast, I do mean no change from the March forecast, but not no change from 07-09. There is a significant growth in general fund revenues projections between 07-09 and 09-11, that is to say between the current biennium and the next one, and indeed that is 20.7% increase in revenues. And the reason for that large growth, even though the economy is not expected to be especially robust, is that we're starting off at a lower base this biennium than we typically would, because the kicker is reducing the amount. The kicker isn't considered an expenditure, it's considered a reduction in revenues. So we're starting off from a lower base, and then going back to a biennium in which there's no kicker being forecast, and that does show a growth of 20.7%. So again, that's a little bit misleading in the sense that it's not, it's certainly not going to be a windfall for the state, but it does, I didn't want to leave the impression that the forecast was saying we'd have the same amount of money next biennium as we do this biennium, because that's not the case.
Can we get the lottery stuff on the record and then have a general discussion, unless you wanted Representative a specific question on this issue?
Well, I have a question on it, but let's go with...
Let's get the lottery summarized, and then we'll have an overall discussion, and I'll come to you first. Mr. Bender.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. If you turn to page 14 of your packet, this is a review of lottery resources and simpler table than it is for general fund. And you can see that the projection is that lottery earnings will be up $9 million from the level that was projected 3 months ago, but that allocations are projected to be higher by $23 million. And again, I think this is due both to actions during the supplemental session and also due to the fact that some allocations increase automatically when the earnings increase because they are constitutionally dedicated to certain funds. So the net impact, though, is that there will be $14.1 million less in lottery resources available for 09-11 than was projected in March. Now, we're still projecting an ending balance here of $11.7 million. Finally, unless there are additional questions, I did want to speak about the corporate 2% kicker. And the question is always whether the 2% kicker is projected to kick for the 09-11 biennium. And under this forecast, there's no projection of either a personal or corporate income tax kicker during the 09-11 biennium. Again, given a number of things that we've been talking about with the general weakness in the economy, that may sound like not a surprising comment, but in terms of threshold, in terms of the personal kicker, under the June forecast, we are $104.8 million below the kicker threshold. So if future forecasts show revenues increase of $105 million more than this one does, then we would again be projecting a personal income tax kicker. So there's not even with the economy as it is, we're still relatively close to the kicker threshold for the personal side. For the corporate side, corporate tax revenues would have to increase $131 million over the current forecast for there to be a corporate kicker. And given the smaller size of the corporate kicker revenues, that's a greater proportion, and that would probably be less likely to occur than a personal kicker. But as of now, neither is projected to occur.
Okay, thank you. Now we'll open it up for discussion. Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. A question, a couple of things, I think. One of the things that always strikes me that we're kind of playing with figures that are old and outdated. The income figures that we're looking at least as far as income tax and the infusion of money there, is not a consequence of the 08 year, but it's a consequence of the 07 year type of thing. I wonder, I therefore am always somewhat pessimistic or skeptical, I suppose. And one of the areas in particular is in the capital gains thing. Do we have any way, or is any way taken into consideration, is it taken into consideration those individuals who, or groups, who may, when the market is down, sell off specifically for the purposes of getting tax write-offs for the following year, sort of thing. And then, you know, buy back in some other type of an investment to on the basis of the economy or these things will improve. I look at the stocks that, in the Oregonian, which is not a real good financial paper to look at, but they've got that little charts where the the year averages are for a number of stocks, and all of them have swung off to the very low, or not all, but many of them have swung off to the very low end, and in fact probably some very solid companies that have much better long range projections than what that loss might incur. So is that is that taking a loss, kind of as a way of managing your money, taken into consideration as you deal with these forecasts?
I know that the Office of Economic Analysis does forecasts of the revenue collections that will accrue from capital gains, net of the capital losses, types of losses that you're talking about. I'm really not familiar with the details of that methodology, though, and would need to get more information about that for you.
Okay. Thank you, Ryan.
Okay, thanks. Ms. Morgan, did you have a question?
I'm fine.
Anybody else? Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you, Jim. I wanted to respond to someone suggested that we had a concern about the word collapse in the real estate market. Perhaps unrestricted deceleration of home value might suit that person better. Nonetheless, I have two specific examples. A house on Trent Jones adjacent to the Eagle Point Golf Course, not on the golf course, but across the street. Was built in 2004, last sold for $413,000. It's been on the market for 14 months. It's currently in a short sale situation at $189,000 with no takers. That's $124,000 loss in equity. The second one is on Havencrest in Klamath Falls, built in 1996, last sold for $389,000. Is currently on the market for $289,000. It's been on the market for 150 days. Both of these are well-kept middle-class homes, imminently saleable 18 months ago, no takers today. At that, the Havencrest home in Klamath Falls has a loss of equity of $100,000 at this point, still no takers. So given our state's recent dependence on home equity acceleration, we're seeing a deceleration and collapse may not be overstatement. Thank you.
It's pretty serious in some parts of the state. Thank you. Those are tough statistics. Any other questions, comments, clarifications, understandings. Mr. Kirchner.
Unusual for me, but I'd like to point out a slight optimistic point in the economy here. And, you know, and I'm not an expert, and I stand to be corrected either by Mr. Bender or the Office of Economic Analysis, but some of the reading I've come across would indicate that many businesses and industrial partners are actually in pretty good shape. Their earnings are in good shape, while our financial partners have been hit very hard, and the housing market, as Senator Whitsitt talks about, been hit very, very hard. That business in general has done a pretty good job of preparing for and weathering a lot of the recession. And to me, that gives me some optimism that it's not all doom and gloom, and remains to be seen what happens in the next 6-8 months. But I think that that's something we should also keep in mind as we talk to people, that we don't overly paint a picture that's all one-sided. We as Ways and Means, I think, have to emphasize that. I think it's very appropriate. But at the same time, I hold out some hope that we are maybe bottoming out and that the financial structures are in place for a robust recovery, albeit over a slightly longer period of time.
And, colleagues, we'll have a little more time to talk about what this means for our decisions when we listen to the discussion about salary reserve allocations and the impacts of differential salary reserve distributions on different agencies. So it will come back later in the agenda today. Mr. Bender, we owe you our thanks for stepping up here and substituting and helping walk us through a better understanding of this forecast. Thank you very much. Mr. Rocco, let's move on to our interim committee work plan.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Members, there's in your packets after the military department grant request item, there is a memo to the committee from the co-chairs that we're going to use as the basis for a discussion of what the remainder of the interim is going to look like for the committee. I'm going to briefly go over the technical side of this, and then I think the co-chairs want to talk about the more philosophical approach to what we're going to do, this, try to do this interim. After the February session was over, legislative leadership decided to continue the work of the Interim Joint Ways and Means Committee through the remainder of this interim. They also set the dates for the emergency board meetings, and those dates are listed in the first paragraph of the memo. They are on June 26th and 27th, September 25th and 26th, and December 4th and 5th. So based on that, what we tried to do was schedule three additional meetings of the Interim Ways and Means Committee around those dates so that they would not be exactly the same, but coincide with roughly with those dates. In addition, I believe leadership has decided not to appoint this interim the Joint Legislative Audit Committee and the Joint Legislative Committee on Information Management and Technology, which have traditionally served during the interim, and instead has indicated that the Ways and Means Committee would take up that kind of activity this interim in lieu of those committees being appointed. At the bottom of that first page, you can see the dates that we have determined for the Ways and Means Committee today, September 18th, October 16th, and November 20th. But we anticipate those to be full-day meetings, unlike today, which we think today was more of an introduction to what we're going to do, so we thought it would only take about a half a day. But the next three meetings will be full-day meetings. Basically, each of the meetings are going to be composed of roughly four components, if you want to think of it in that way. We're going to try to do some training and education activities around the performance management system that the state has engaged in and is attempting to modify and develop more. We will do federal grants like we did today, since this committee has statutory authority to approve those, and it helps agencies to get that moving so that we don't have to wait for emergency board meetings. There will be a series of reports that we're going to get from agencies that were directed either by budget note or budget report language to go to either the emergency board or the Ways and Means Committee. So we will have a series of those kinds of reports. And then I think the co-chairs are interested in having some more in-depth budget discussions, less about 07-09, more about 09-11. And we anticipate bringing in agencies within dealing with a program area or two per meeting and having agencies talk to you about their primary interests for their 09 budgets, 09-11 budgets, and other issues that they're dealing with, so that the committee can give some direction to LFO in developing the legislatively adopted budget for 09-11. Typically, we've been in a response mode to the governor's recommended budget, and I think the co-chairs are interested in taking a more proactive approach towards developing the legislative budget for 09-11. On the second page of the memo, there's a listing of some bullet listing of some topics that may be discussed in front of the committee. I'm not going to go over those, but just for your information and review. And that extends onto the third page of the memo. In addition, we wanted to talk briefly about a couple other things that we're intending to do. We are going, right now we've started a selective audits of performance measure data going out to a set of agencies that we chose, and we're trying to verify their processes for reporting the data that you see in all of their key performance measures that are presented to the Ways and Means Committee. So we are doing that, and we will prepare a report for the next session on what we find in those audits. And we're also getting assistance from agency internal auditors in some of the larger agencies. They're working with us and doing a similar type of audit, so we should be able to audit a fair number of agencies' performance measures, and not all of their measures. We're picking a sample of each agency's measures. We also have attached an outline of the performance management training that we're considering doing in the next meetings, and Don Farr from LFO is here to go over that with you very briefly, just to show you what we have in mind. And then another thing that we're going to do is that we have a new person on staff who is an IT professional and is developing a way for the Ways and Means Committee to have a general approach towards reviewing and approving technology projects, and we're going to have that individual come in and demonstrate the model of approach that we're looking at using. This is something I know the committee over the past number of years has wanted to have better information on this from the legislative side, since we have always been dependent on the executive branch for information about technology projects, and so we're very happy to have this individual on board, and we'll probably do this in September at the September meeting. So
thanks, Ms. Farr.
Don Farr, Legislative Fiscal Office. You should have a handout that is the fourth page of the memo. Is that right, Kim?
Yes, it is.
So, just a reminder, effective this biennium, the administration of the Key Performance Measure System transitioned from the Progress Board to Budget and Management. So, position was created in Budget and Management Division, and then my position was created the previous biennium to put more attention and focus on the Key Performance Measurement System and thinking more broadly about how we might use performance measures in the budget process. So, it's been a very busy year, and I think you also have a copy of a draft brief that talks about some of the changes that have occurred in the last year and some of the activities and projects that we've been engaged in. So this first, there are three modules that we've envisioned proposing for training around this system. The first one is really just, here's all the changes and kinds of activities and focus that we've brought to the system so far this biennium. And that would be in the September meeting, about an hour to an hour and a half. The next segment would be in the October meeting, and this is really stepping back and saying, okay, how do we make this more of a legislative tool for all of you to not be focused quite so much on the mechanics of the measures, but having the measures actually inform on the budget decision-making process? What does that look like, and how do we make that happen? So that would be a more interactive, more of a discussion kind of format, and then the idea is to come back in November and actually sort of role-play, have a practice session where we actually work with this process that we design in October to kind of get the kinks out of it so that we have a robust process going into the 2009 session. And again, all of this is designed to shift the focus a little bit from just the mechanics of the performance measure to having them be more effective tools in the budget process for you and for the agencies as well. So I don't know if there's any questions. That's a pretty high level orientation to what we're trying to accomplish with that training.
It might, and then we can have discussion. Essentially, what we're trying to do is prepare all of us together to work as a committee to get a little bit more in front of this process. We may not fully get there this cycle, but to move toward more of a legislative budget initiative or priorities so that we are not simply in a mode of reacting to what the executive branch proposes. The co-chair and I want to engage the entire committee in that so that it is a recommendation or a preference or a direction that represents the entire committee and a substantial part of the legislature, because with a 20-member committee, we collectively are a major part of the legislature, so that we are setting some expectations and it is more of an equal discussion, if you will, between the legislative and executive branches. So that's the framework for it. Did you want to?
Okay. I have some comments.
All right, fine, and we'll follow up with that. Senator Johnson.
I appreciate the direction that you're headed, and I think it's wise. I want to go back, though, and sort of grovel in the minutia for just a second. While I think your proactive look is very good, I think there also is a responsibility for us to do a backward look to see how some of the initiatives are performing. And in this bulleted list, one of the things that seems conspicuously absent to me is any kind of review, with the exception of OWIN, any kind of review of the big technology projects. And the one that I would specifically like to make a case to include here is what used to be called Scenic. I have no idea what it's called now. The name changes all the time.
It's data center.
In the data center, and I would very much like to make a case to add a specific review of how that's performing. My particular interest is in charges to the participating agencies that at least I've heard rumors are excessive. And it seems to me that if we're going to try to get ahead of the curve, we need to, in planning our budgeting, we need to look back and see if there's any instruction from stuff that we've done historically that maybe hasn't turned out as well as the initial promise.
Okay. I saw another hand over here. Senator Gordley.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. With the shift of key performance measure work to DAS, did I hear that correctly?
That's correct.
What does that mean with regard to the work and relevance of the progress board?
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Gordley, the progress board, its primary mission, as I understand it, is really around Oregon Shines and the Oregon benchmarks. And the governor directed them to develop, in collaboration with the legislature and I think it was the Secretary of State at the time, the current system that we have today. And some of that context is in the draft brief that are in the materials that you have. We maintain through our infrastructure links to the Oregon benchmarks. So Oregon, we're very unique in that we do have this hierarchy of measures. The Oregon benchmarks are designed to be more societal level, you know, your longer range, highest level outcomes. And under that umbrella would be the state key performance measures. We're working on an automated system of the key performance measure process And within that system, we should ultimately have better real-time data links to the Oregon benchmark. So we're real excited about that possibility as well. But that will be a couple years in the future, probably.
Just one follow-up.
Yes, Senator.
Should we anticipate a change in the budget request coming from the Oregon Progress Board? Is this, I'm trying to get at what this means for workload.
Well, in terms of the key performance measurement system, since they're not in that business right now, they are focusing on Oregon Shines, which is due for an update. In terms of whether they need additional resources to pursue that mandate, that's something I would have to follow up with them to get back to you on.
Thank you.
I don't know, maybe Ken even has some specifics now. Okay.
I think, Senator Gridley, that their current budget is not very large, as you know, and I think it has been for several years now basically a maintenance budget. So, and we don't know outside of Oregon Shines 3, you know, which is undergoing some work right now. We don't know of any other initiatives that they're going to be looking at doing.
Okay. Senator Whitsitt?
Yeah, there are. Thank you, Madam Chair. There's a couple of other things that I don't see represented in that bullet list. One of those is any indication of a review of the Clark versus OHSU, which I believe has a potential for extreme cost increases at all levels of government, local and state as well. And the other is I don't see the federal payments to Will Timber County's address there. With the current games that are going on in Washington, D.C., it appears that we're going to have about a $500 million hole in our budget for that period. The counties are going to have that, and as we all know, every citizen in the county is one of our constituents. So,
thank you. Thank you. So, Mr. Co-Chair.
Those are good additions, and I'd urge everyone, I think we tried to solicit some input earlier on, but anyone that has other additions to what we should be looking at in the next 6-8 months, please, that's huge. This is not a definitive list, so I want to make sure everyone has a chance to do that. Representative Jensen.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I want to second Senator Johnson's request.
Okay.
And I would like to throw in there also that the this technology thing with the Oregon Department of Education maybe be included in that, which
Okay. Well, as Mr. Rocco said, technology proposals and projects as a whole will be part of our discussion, but we'll make sure we pay particular attention to that. Senator Schroeder?
I did have some general comments, if I may, Madam Co-Chair. I think that this is this work plan is a unique opportunity for this committee. Number one, it's unique to have a committee in the interim. And I think working as a committee as a whole, as we look and trying to develop a budget, our budget for 09-11 is a unique opportunity for us. And to me, that means coming together bipartisanly for the most part. There will be some programs that we're just going to be different on. That's the way it is. But for the most part, I would hope this would be a core group that will build some camaraderie about certain aspects of the budget that will transcend the politics during the legislative session. Well, this is a political body we're in, so I'm not going to say it's not going to happen in some degree. But to one of the bigger disappointments I've had over the last few years is the politics that have gone on in Ways and Means, and prefer not to have that happen, at least to the extent you all have been seeing it. So if we can build that camaraderie, build some basic budgets, but I believe that 90% of the stuff that we do, we all pretty much agree on. We're asking all the same questions and want to make sure things work correctly. And I appreciate all the comments from everyone today and in past meetings. So this is hopefully a great opportunity. It also helps set the stage for a more collaborative relationship with our partners and maybe with the executive branch. They will be hopefully giving us some idea of what they're going to be doing and expecting. We'll be able to vet that with a little more rational and cooler heads in the interim. get some expectation of the needs and desires now so that we can shape our own discussions, listen to one another, and hopefully come to some general consensus about a great many of these issues. And that'll also make things better during sessions so that we can get into some of the in-depth questions that Senator Witz, Senator Johnson, Senator Jensen have, Representative Jensen have alluded to, and do a better job being stewards of the fiscal budget. So I think this could be a really, really great opportunity. I hope everyone attends as often and as regularly as they can to help shape that. The other piece that, again, I have particular interest in, I think Representative Morgan has a particular interest in, and hopefully all of you do too, and that's making this performance-based budgeting real. You know, we've tried over the years to get it up on the radar screen. I think moving the, now that, you know, the progress board has schooled us in, you know, the benchmarks and how key performance measures may be used, we've worked collaboratively with DAS and LFO, it's now time to make it real. And part of the reality here is, I think, moving it into BAM, budget management, so that the agencies take this seriously. And it's not a punitive thing. You know, this is, I'll guarantee you, I'm sure one of you agree, that 99% of agencies see this is just one more hoop the legislature is making them jump through. And that's not the goal. The goal here is to make it helpful and rewarding to these people so that they can actually see there's some rationality in the process. It's not just because Kurt Schrader's co-chair or Representative Nolan's co-chair. It's because the key performance measures indicate certain funding things should be going on. And if we all have, right, we all, every one of us has particular programs or agencies or educational partners we like, I think our goal from this point on should be to encourage them to take these performance measures seriously so that they're shown in the best light and have the best chance of continuing the funding they get, because current service level is not inviolate. I think represent my co-chair has spoken to that many times. It's something that, you know, if you're getting good results, sure, well, we'll probably think about doing the same thing. But if you want to do new things, you have to show up. One of the points that Representative Johnson made is with the technology people. I would say we've done a lot of new innovative things this last session. We were very targeted in what we did. We didn't do everything. We looked at nursing skilled workforce training. We had a bunch of innovative technology things that we did. I would hope that we'd review those very seriously and their performance or their ongoing performance to make sure they're warranted continued funding or enhanced funding. So I would commend to you the my first opportunity to really look at the draft budget brief 2008 number 4 that talks about the pluses and minuses of the performance measure process to date, and I think Dawn has accurately captured them, and the goal would be to make these very real. I hope that in October and I guess it's November where the training occurs, that the role playing is taken seriously. It'll help train us how to ask the right questions rather than caught up in an Oregon University system love fest about, you know, what they're doing. We're going to be asking key questions about their performance measures and how they're doing, and be able to ask them intelligently, ask them about budget drivers. There are factors beyond key performance measures that we want to take into account. Although I'm a big key performance measure uber-aris guy, I think there's an opportunity for us to be smart about their limitations at the same time. But I really hope that this works out, and hope it's of value, and into the league will be the judge. So please give us feedback as to what's working and what's not working, what questions we should or should not be asking to make this better for you all to make good decisions. I'm done.
Okay. Senator Johnson.
Thank you. I guess two reactions that I would have to the comments that you just made that I agree with in the main. Two things. One of them is that if the performance measures are going to really mean anything, I think part of the exercise that we're going through right now and anticipate going through moving forward is that there are consequences. It has been my observation, both as an agency person preparing performance measures and as a ways and means person listening to them, that there's been a lot of wiggle room. We change definitions when standards can't be met. We count something different. I think we have to enforce the discipline to make a matter. And if there isn't performance, to have the strength of character or the political courage to say this isn't working, and something ends if it isn't performing. The second thing is that in doing performance measures, simply counting the things, whatever the element is, I don't want to lose the possibility for continuous improvement coming forward from the agencies. And I'd like to underscore that it may not be completely reflected in the performance measures that tend to be a little bit static. I had an instance the other day speaking with an agency questioning something that I thought was just contra common sense, And the answer that was sort of hissed back at me was, well, you, the legislature, make us do it. Well, if it contravenes common sense to continue to perform an activity, I'd like to leave open the door for agencies to come back and say, this doesn't make sense anymore. And I'll give you the specific example just because it's so stark. Publishing a DSL lease twice in a local newspaper for a cost of $3,600 when the lease only generated $270 per annum. And when I questioned, you know, I know we're working for the Common School Fund, but did we suspend common sense? The answer was, you guys made us do it, so we're just doing what you said. I'd like the partnership between the legislature and the agencies where they have the flexibility as part of performance measures to come back and say, this doesn't make sense anymore, and we'd like the legislature to review this. Times have changed, elements have changed, something's changed that no longer makes the status quo acceptable. And I just don't want to lose that incentive for continuous improvement from the agencies outside of the sidebars of performance measures.
Good point.
Anybody else? One more comment. Sorry, I always lie about last comment, don't I? Continuous improvement, very important. Senate Bill 1099 passed, was a House and Senate bill, so we want to make certain that you guys actually recommend people to be on that commission. We've got a lot of certified smart people in this state. Many of you know who they are through your own travels and associations. So we want to make sure that is a very smart, robust board that can recommend things to this body, again, nonpartisan, that will help improve how we do business in the state of Oregon. So that's a good comment, Senator.
Madam Chair, members, on the third page of that draft brief, there's a table, and there's actions planned for the future. The top one on that actions plan for the future is a brief comment about the Committee on Performance Excellence from Senate Bill 1099. This committee is trying to get started right now, and I believe within the next few days we're going to send out a notification to try to solicit some membership on this committee, because it's a mixture of public members, legislators, and executive branch members, I believe.
And union as well.
And union members also.
Yes. Senator Whitford?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just briefly, I'm a very strong supporter of performance-based budgeting, but I do believe that it has to be measured to be effective. And the question is, how will we measure performance-based budgeting? How will we verify those outcomes? Because if you're not able to do that, then it's an exercise in futility, in my opinion.
Good point. And I'm going to wrap it up here because I'm going to take you at your previous word, Senator.
You will be auditing them. We'll be auditing the data. And that'll be anyone has...
We, the committee.
Yeah.
And as we get into the session, subcommittees will really drill down pretty tightly into those things. But what I'd like to say is, as we know, clearly we've got some interest in this interim work plan, which I'm delighted to hear. I am hoping that with the mix that Mr. Rocco described of some training so that we really understand the language and the mechanisms that LFO has available for us, that that represents perhaps a little less than half of the time we spend together during the interim, but that more than half of our time is spent in dialogue and discussion and debate, because we won't always agree on where our priorities are and what emphasis we want LFO to put on building a legislative budget, so that the meat of our discussion is around the substance, the outcome of our decisions, the actual budgeting. But in order to do that effectively, I think we've clearly demonstrated that we all need to be on the same level of understanding of the tools that we have available. So look forward to that, and please, we've made notes. We've made sure that LFO has the notes of the items that have been identified by Representative Jensen, Senator Johnson, Senator Whitsitt. We encourage you to think of additional items, specific issues, projects, initiatives that you would like to have on our agenda for discussion among the committee during the next three meetings, and communicate that to Mr. Rocco. He will coordinate that with the two co-chairs. Yes, Yes, Senator.
Is raising them here sufficient, or do you want them in writing?
No, you're done.
Okay.
You don't need to. We've got the ones that have been raised here. Thank you. You don't need to send those in separately.
Can you take one more?
You bet, okay. Senator.
Thank you very much. Picking up on discussion that we've had in this committee over time, I would strongly urge that we have an opportunity to gain the same level of understanding of how our state agencies are performing with regard to their affirmative action performance. And so if we could create an opportunity for the governor's affirmative action director to make a presentation to the committee that gives us that information, that broad overview, and allows us to better understand how we're doing and what are the remaining challenges, I think it would serve us all well.
Yeah, thanks. Okay. Not the last time you have a chance, but thanks for that discussion. Let's move on to 2009-11 budget instructions.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Mr. Rocco.
Sheila.
Oh, Sheila. Ms. Baker. Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I just hope to take a few minutes of your time this morning. My assignment is to basically give you some information on what's happening right now as agencies are developing their 2009-11 budgets, and to highlight a few issues that went out in the budget instructions to agencies so that you can keep those in mind as you're getting excited for next biennium's budget work. This is what the budget instructions to agencies look like. I'm not going to go through it in great detail, but if anyone is interested, it is online, I believe, at the Department of Administrative Services website. But there is considerable instruction to agencies at the detail level of how they are supposed to build their budgets. What you should have in your packets is a piece of paper that looks like this. It's a very condensed version, obviously, of what the budget process is going to look like, and then there's a timeline that I will go over very briefly with you. So if you want to turn to that material, that's what I'll work from in terms of the presentation. The first part of this is just to either refresh your memories or to, for those of you that are newer to the process, to highlight what's going on in terms of how agencies are building their budgets. The budget development process, as you know, has three particular budgets throughout the process that are developed. The one that's underway now in terms of development is the agency request budget. The governor then considers those as they are submitted and compiles the governor's recommended budget. And then, of course, the legislature weighs in, makes decisions on those proposals, and comes up with its legislatively adopted budget. For 2009, the agency request budgets for some smaller agencies, other funds agencies for the most part, are due August 1st. The more complicated, bigger general fund agencies are due September 1st. So by September 1st of this year, agencies have to have their budgets put together and submitted to the Department of Administrative Services. The Department of Administrative Services this time around has streamlined the instructions somewhat. They've complicated them in some areas in terms of getting additional information, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. But in terms of the mechanical process, they've eliminated a few steps. They've pushed some of the steps back further to help make sure that agencies will indeed meet those August and September dates for their budget submittals. The budget starts with the base budget, which is basically their budget coming out of the last legislative session, updated for any emergency board actions, in this case the supplemental session actions, and administrative adjustments that may have been made to their non-limited funds, if they have any, through April of 2008. That then is the legislatively approved budget at that time. There's also adjustments for personal services, scheduled debt service, service, things that were approved in for the current biennium that will roll forward into the next biennium. And as you're talking about the salary plot, for example, that's an example of something that is rolled forward and assumed in that base budget. Its effect moving forward from 07-09 into 09-11. Capital construction is not included in the base budget. That is always considered on a case-by-case basis, separate from the operating budgets. The essential budget level, then, or as it used to be known, current service level, is the estimated cost to continue all the programs that you have approved for this biennium into the next biennium. So it's the base budget plus packages, essential packages is the title that's used for those, that cover things like inflation, mandated caseload growth, roll-up of programs that are phased in mid-biennium to cover those costs for a full 24 months. So those kinds of items roll up to the essential budget level. And then, of course, there's policy packages that agencies submit on top of those for policy changes that have a budget impact. And if those are approved, of course, that then becomes part of the agency's budget. And I've noted there that the budget is built. Agencies have, of course, their own process internally for building their budgets, but statewide, the budget is built in the ORBIT system, Oregon's Budget Information Tracking System. So ORBITS is a key component of this, and it's now used both to input the budget data, it reports that data, and it helps monitor budget execution. So it is a statewide system with a couple of exceptions of agencies that provide that data in the system, but data is collected for all agencies in there, and it's rolled up on a statewide level. What I wanted to reference here in terms of the timeline, you can see on the technical side what agencies have been doing basically since December, or some of them even a little earlier, of last year. They've been working on what's the structure that we're going to report our budget at. What was the, for the 05-07 biennium, what did we actually spend? What are our revenue estimates moving forward? For those things that aren't covered by the budget instructions, and we'll talk about those in a minute, what do we need to ask for and what gets approved? For the essential budget level pieces, personnel information rolling forward, and then for the essential packages, we need to put those into the system, and then we need to put the policy packages into the system. So all of that is happening over this particular time frame. Now, there is one line there, e-boards and estimates, that doesn't have a time frame associated with it. That's one of the streamlining pieces that the Department of Administrative Services did this time around. They eliminated a particular column in ORBITS to, because it wasn't providing much useful information, and so agencies now have more time to spend on the other necessary elements of the budget mechanics, and again with the hope that the timelines throughout the process will be better met by eliminating things that aren't very useful and focusing on the things that are necessary for budget development. So I'll just touch briefly on a few key issues. One of the questions always is, what are the inflation factors that agencies get to build into their budgets? For this time, for the biennium, the Department of Administrative Services has indicated they can build in 2.8% for the biennium for general inflation and non-state employee personnel costs. So, for example, if they're contracting for some services, they can build in 2.8% inflation over the biennium. Medical services, 4.4%. Now, agencies have an ability to ask for other cost increases on an exception basis. So, for example, one of the biggest examples is the Oregon Health Plan, which is required to pay for capitation rates at a certain audited level. but it exceeds generally the 4.4% that general medical services inflation would have. So that's something that's approved on an exception basis. Another example, Oregon Youth Authority, they have pharmacy costs that exceed that 4.4% medical inflation. So they've come in and said, well, you know, our actual costs are much higher than this. We need an exception to build those higher costs into the budget. So there is a process, and there are exceptions that are made, but the general factors there are noted, and that's something that agencies will have to consider as they're building their budgets for the next biennium. It's important to note that there's no budget targets for agencies as they're building their agency request budgets, and it's commonly known as there is a, perhaps for some agencies, a threshold of embarrassment when it comes to submitting their agency request budget and deciding what goes in and what doesn't go in. But there is no budget target per se, so agencies can ask for whatever they feel like they need to implement their programs, expand on their programs, whatever. However, they do have to identify, not build into the budget, but identify 10% reduction options. It initially was just for general fund and lottery funded programs, but now other funds and federal funded programs as well have to identify, if you took a 10% cut, where would you take that cut? So that's information that they have to submit in the agency request budget, and then that moves forward both in the governor's budget process and in the legislatively adopted process. This time around, agencies have been instructed to present greater detail on information technology investments. So for those particular investments, you will see more information in the agency's budget document about that. And there's also been an emphasis on facilities operation and maintenance, particularly deferred maintenance, as a result of some legislative direction from the last session. So there will be more information from agencies on that as well. And as noted, the key performance measure process, it's been automated to some extent at this point, and some of the reporting has been consolidated, and it's been aligned more closely with the budget process. So, for example, before their annual report on their key performance measures was due in September, at the end of September, which didn't allow for time to get that into the agency's request budget. This time around, those reporting dates are moved up so that what you will see in terms of an annual report will be the most recent one at the time the agency's request budget comes in, and then when the governor's budget comes over from the Department of Administrative Services. So we are in the thick of budget development on the executive branch side. Agencies are working diligently both on the technical side and on the policy side, and we will see the fruits of that labor in several months.
Great, thanks. Open for discussion or questions. I'm trying to be mindful that we have members who need to leave, and I want to make sure they have an opportunity to participate in the last item on the agenda. So if there are questions of general interest, Representative Jensen.
Just very quickly, can you explain to me early agencies and late agencies?
Yes, Madam Chair and Representative Jensen, to spread out the workload a little bit on the Department of Administrative Services Budget and Management Division. They've said some agencies have to submit their material a month earlier. The more complicated, bigger agencies have a little bit more time to get it in.
Good clarification. Anything else? Mr. Kuchar.
Just a question. In the past, the budget instructions have been, you know, a 2- or 3-page document in minute detail, all the stuff that agencies should have available for us. But I always worry with that document, at least the ones I've seen in the past, that, you know, that the key performance measures become lost in that litany of things that we want them to do. Are these instructions clear that the budget performance measures are the most important thing, and that this is what the committee will be focusing on, and this ergo they should be making sure that stuff that they have in exceptionally good quality for us?
Madam Chair, Senator Schrader, the instructions are on the executive branch side, what that gets put into the budget document, it does not include and, in fact, makes a disclaimer that what the legislature needs in terms of budget presentation materials, it may include some of this. We would expect it would, performance measures, for example, but there may be other things that they ask for. So I guess the answer to your question is no, I don't think it's clear to agencies yet what our priorities are going to be in terms of presentation material, but we have worked to, for example, incorporate some of the things we asked for last time, like how you would measure performance on your policy option packages to build that into the agency's budget documentation as well. So the answer is no, it doesn't cover the materials that will be presented to the legislature. That still is something to be determined, but we have, where we think agencies will be required to present some of that material, we have tried to build it into the executive branch budget instructions.
Quick follow-up, Madam Co-Chair.
Yes.
So then when, in the interest of making sure they really know what we expect from them in the budget presentation materials, when would we be sending our missive to them so that they can be fully prepared in advance and not have to scramble at the last minute or think they're scrambling at the last minute?
Madam Chair, Senator, normally we send that out in the late fall, if we can get it together by that time. I think this time with in the interim committee meeting, with these three meetings, that's one of the goals that we are looking for the committee to give us some direction on exactly what they want to see presented to them in the 09 session. So I would suspect by the late November time period, early December, we would send out instructions to agencies for their presentation materials for the following mid to late January.
Just my last comment. I would hope that, given the speed and interest that this body is showing in preparing for the next session, that we actually accomplish the presentation request before November. I'd prefer it to be one of our top early topics in our September meeting so we can make sure these agencies have clear understanding of what we expect. I don't think it's nuclear medicine, and perhaps some email communication over the summer at our leisure as we travel around this great state and country, it would be appropriate. I think it's going to be important. Otherwise, agencies will claim that it's too late, they didn't know, and they're going to present the same old stuff, and I don't think anyone in this body is interested in seeing that.
We'll work on the timing. November's better than May of 09.
That is true.
Senator Burgess.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It seems to me, though, that if we're going to spend time with our work plan, and that's our focus, there's a slip, twist of the cup on the lip here. If the agencies aren't aware that that's what we are building up and preparing for, it seems like we should all be on the same page.
Senator, there is a natural dialogue between the legislative and executive branches. The agencies will be aware of our work schedule, and certainly DAS and the folks in budget and management will be, as well as the folks in the governor's office. But I think there's a natural and appropriate kind of tension and debate between the two branches because we have different roles in the process. Senator Johnson?
Thank you. Following up on my earlier comments about continuous improvement, it seems to me as I reflect on the agency presentations that I've seen during my service in the legislature that frequently they devolved into just a celebration of successes. I would very much like to make a case for some part of the budget presentation to be a period of thoughtful introspection by the agency to suggest areas where they're struggling and acknowledge that up front. Some of these hearings turn out to be kind of volleyball games of back and forth with legislators trying to probe out where some of the deficiencies are, and maybe as part of the continuous improvement there would be an opportunity for agencies to self-disclose.
They will be more inclined to do that depending on how we react to their disclosures. Anybody else?
Thank you. Ms. Baker? Last item on the agenda, Mr. Hill. We're moving to a review of salary reserve issues.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Darian Hill from the Legislative Fiscal Office. The Legislative Fiscal Office thought that you might like to be briefed on the supplemental appropriation or the special purpose appropriation for supplemental funding of employee compensation. As you know, there was a $125 million special purpose appropriation approved by the 2007 legislature during the regular session. The costs for certain employee compensation components that have developed since the budgets were approved can be covered with that money. And, for instance, it can cover the cost of negotiated contracts and certain salary increases for management and unrepresented employees. But it also can cover the cost of some pension obligation bond. The costs there are redistributed as we get to know what the costs are more exacting to the agencies. We start out, we try to estimate it, and then as we really bring folks on and we get true employee costs, they redistribute those costs.
Mr. Hill, before you continue, I want to make sure we put this item in the appropriate context. Senator Schrader and I did ask Legislative Fiscal to work with the agencies to understand the impacts of differential distributions from 0 to 100% of the funds that the legislature reserved for compensation issues. This committee today does not have any authority to take an action on that. The E-Board is the only committee that has the authority to release any of those funds. Many members of this committee also serve on the E-Board, and because regardless of whether you serve on the E-Board, the issue has a big impact on the budgets that we will consider as a committee in the regular session. I wanted the members of this committee to have an opportunity to really query LFO about the impacts and about the options, and to have a discussion that doesn't end up in a decision because we don't have that authority, but raises issues that the E-Board should consider when it takes up this question at the end of this month. I'm sorry, I didn't get that context before. Mr. Hill?
Madam Co-Chair, before kind of ask you a question, I see four scenarios, and none of which include the legislature and this committee honoring the commitment that we made and allocating 100% of the funding. So I'm just wondering why that's not one of the scenarios that we're analyzing or talking about.
We'll get to that when we go through the discussion, but briefly, what we did was ask what would be the impact if the E-Board chose to distribute less than the full amount. And so that's why the answer came back. Here's what would happen at different levels that are less than the full amount. Mr. Hill?
Madam Co-Chair, another component that can have the costs covered is there was a temporary change that the Department of Administrative Services made around the public employees' retirement system rates, the PERS rates. We had traditionally used a blended rate for all agencies, and they implemented a change in that because the police and fire folks can actually have a slightly higher rate. And they implemented a change after all the budgets had been approved. And after that point, about 5 months after it was discovered that had taken place, they reinstituted the blended rate because there was a huge shift to the general fund costs by implementing that. And it was decided that we would go ahead and go back to the blended rate for the rest of this biennium, and we would roll that in, as Sheila had mentioned, into the 09-11 budget at the proper way, so that the police and fire would have their rate and everyone else would have a separate rate. But there is a cost of about $3.7 million for that 1 5-month period of time where the payroll system actually had those two rates separate. There are a few things that would not be covered by the special purpose appropriation, and those were things that the governor had awarded to management service as a supplemental salary increase. And those things were for salary ranges 24 and above, there was a 3% increase for managers. There was an addition of a step and removal of the bottom step both in July 1st of 2007 and July 1st of 2008, and a 10% increase for all agency heads. The reason those were would not be covered by this is because the governor had said at the time that those would be covered within an agency's budget. Lottery funds, other funds, and federal funds will also be requested.
Excuse me, Mr. Hill. Senator, what's it?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. On those step increases, Mr. Hill, could you give us an idea of what actual compensation increase each of those step increases would have?
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Witzek, can I get a point of clarification? Are you talking about overall what the total cost of those supplemental management increases are?
In addition to the step and the removal of the bottom step effective July 1, so you bump everybody up a step, what is the difference, the percentage difference in the compensation between those two steps?
Sure. I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Senator Witzek, it's about 5% per step.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
When the
Department of Administrative Services actually brings forward the letter to distribute these dollars, they will also be requesting lottery funds, other funds, and federal funds limitation along with the general fund. A lot of it is concentrated on the general fund because that's how much is set aside in the special purpose appropriation. Now, getting on to Madam Co-Chair's point, originally the plan was to distribute the funds during the supplemental session. The decision was made to postpone those funds because the revenue situation was somewhat turned upside down because the forecast was down. And so a couple of issues that we knew, that, as was mentioned earlier, April is a volatile month. We get all of the tax returns in during that time, and it was also decided that it would be better to just wait and see a little bit, get a little more time in our belts. So as that occurred, both Legislative Fiscal Office and Budget Management requested from agencies plans on both what happened would happen if you got 50% of what your portion of the compensation fund was, and what would happen if you got none. And agencies took that to task, and if you look here, there's a whole bunch of papers that I think are all pinned together for you here. And I'm not going to go through page by page what's in here, but I'd like to at least go through the layout with you and let you know what's here. Each and every agency that had general fund filled out one of these plans. And what we looked at here, and if you want to start, the first thing that's here is there's basically these are broken down by the program areas, and you all know what those are. But on top there is a statewide summary. And each one of these has basically a two-page scenario. The first one is the 50% plan, and the back page is the basically if you've got no salary distribution plan. And if you look up at the top of each one, on line one, the collective bargaining package, those are the dollars that are driven specifically for compensated salary increases. As I mentioned, both the PERS and the POB, those costs, the general fund costs, are on lines two and three. The supplemental management package, we included that in there so that you can see how much that will cost, but those costs, again, would not be compensated by the special purpose appropriation. Then going down here, what we gave was some instructions in some high-level categories of how would you cover these shortfalls. And one of them on line 8 is regular savings. And again, what agencies identified here was about $9.7 million of just regular savings that they would have. And these would include things where they had programs and things that were potentially costing less than what they had originally been anticipated. Then we looked at some other ideas of, and I guess the other thing under regular savings is just natural to vacancies in positions where you have turnover and those kinds of things. Those would be included there. Some other ideas would be intentionally holding positions vacant. And on line 9, you can see there was listed at about $21.5 million worth of those kind of savings. And then potentially laying off personnel about $21 million. And again, realize this is under the 50% scenario. And I guess before I go on, I would like to give this one caveat. Agencies put a lot of time and effort into this. But we are not even halfway through the biennium yet, and so it's a little difficult for them in some places to really determine what those plans would be. The other piece of this I'd like to say is that LFO has not gone in and analyzed these ideas. We have basically just summarized them here for you. And so as we come closer, and this again was all done before we had the last revenue forecast, as we get a better idea and some sense of where things are going to fall out, we would then put a lot more effort into analyzing those and making sure that those plans are a little more concrete. So continuing on line 11 then, you can see the summary statewide that agencies had about $10.2 billion of services and supply savings. Then there's on lines 12 and 13, savings in other portions of the budget and requests for additional appropriation. And as you go back into each one of these program areas, there is some better descriptors of what agencies have summarized up as those actions.
Give us just one or two examples, though, so that the committee has a flavor of that.
Well, okay, let's do that. If you want, go to the next page, which is actually this, the next page right behind that, then is exactly the same information, only at 100% of basically receiving none of the special purpose appropriation. But if you go to the next section, we've got the education program area. And if you want to go down there, you can look and see that in Section 12, if you go down to the bottom, you can look and see the Department of Higher Ed as a savings in other portions of the budget says that they can meet some of the shortfall through reduction of programmatic fee remissions. And other options, line 14, campuses could use ending balances.
Okay.
That gives you a couple of examples of what kind of things are in there. So if you go through these, and I guess what I'd also like to point out, there are three very large general fund agencies that are highly affected by this, and that would be the Department of Higher Education, the Department of Human Services, and the Department of Corrections. So what we have done in here is, under the education program area, behind that, we went ahead and put the detailed letter that lists out the Department of Higher Education's options. And there are better descriptions for you than just those little footnotes at the bottom, but it will actually take you through and say this is what their proposed plan is. Likewise, under the Human Services one is the DHS one, and under the Public Safety one is the Department of Corrections.
And I'll call the committee's attention to the timeline of those submissions. For example, the letter from OUS is dated April 28th, so it's now 6 weeks out of date, and I think more thought has gone into it, both as the revenue forecast has solidified and they've had more chance to look at what might be a more reasonable way to approach it. But this is a good, at least initial, take on where they might be.
Yeah, Madam Co-Chair, we looked at it as it gives you a general idea of what it is. Again, if we get more solid on where the numbers might be and what the actual distribution might be, you'd have much better plans.
Okay, thanks.
And again, there are detailed lists or detailed plans for every agency that has general fund. We have summarized these up to the program area because otherwise you would have, you know, 75 or 80 different plans in front of you. So from there, I guess to kind of get to Representative Galizio's, there is a sheet that shows four different scenarios. And what happened there was, again, the time frame probably needs to be explained. This was before the revenue forecast came out. And the Legislative Fiscal Office was asked to look at some different scenarios and some potential distribution options, and also where state revenues would be depending on certain things happening. And so without going through all the detail here, but basically there are the four options are to distribute, you know, zero or 25%, 50%, or 75%, depending on where certain revenue numbers came in. And again, this was just kind of put out there for thought. It's not a direct plan. It was never to say that if this certain thing happened, this is what you should do. It was just put out there to kind of give some thought to leadership.
Yeah, it's information for legislators to contemplate.
Okay, lastly, I guess on the second page here of the first handout, we just wanted to list out some outstanding issues. And that's that the latest revenue forecast is back up, but it's still a forecast. And we're only halfway through the biennium, and things could still change. There are still a number of downside risks, as have been pointed out earlier today. And we do have another potential volatile collection period during April of 2009. Further postponement of the distribution might require agencies to start taking actions. As you may or may not remember, during special session when we were, during the early 2001 kind of era, we were making cuts. And the longer you wait in the biennium, the harder it is to implement those reductions. So the longer we wait to distribute some of these funds, the less time folks will have to implement whatever they need to do based upon where the actual distribution is. As Madam Co-Chair pointed out earlier, preliminary budget projections for 2009-11, and I point out that these are very preliminary, as agencies are going in and we're starting to get better personal services dollars and some things like that, the expenditure level is kind of difficult for us to estimate, but current estimates for 2009-11 show that there's not enough revenues to be able to cover the essential budget or current services level budget expenditures. Some agencies will still have shortfalls even if the entire amount is distributed. We have some agencies that are very management service, personal services oriented agencies. They don't have a lot of S&S to help cover some of these things. Remember, if the management supplemental package, they have those. They won't have the funding to be able to handle that. So there may be folks who still will need some money above and beyond, even if you gave out 100% of the special purpose appropriation.
Just a minute, Mr. Hill. Representative Morgan.
Is it possible, Madam Co-Chair, to get... I'm not real clear on what you're trying to explain to us there with the additional shortfalls. Can you give us an example?
I would be happy to. The Land Use Board of Appeals has several positions that are management service positions. They don't traditionally have a lot of turnover in those positions, so they don't have vacancy savings. They don't have a lot of S&S in their budget that they might be able to, you know, make cuts in those things. So what you've got is if you compensate them for their traditional things, the cost of living adjustment and those kinds of things. But with the management supplemental package being on top of that, and it's not funded within the $125 million, they are going to have a very difficult time finding places in their budget to have those funds. They may be in to ask for that piece of their budget.
And in general, agencies in that situation would be some of the smaller, particularly agencies that are mostly of a management services, not a lot of technical or administrative positions.
Exactly, Madam Chair. Very smaller, much smaller agencies.
They just have less flexibility. Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Hill, I believe you just said that the 2009-11 revenue projections are inadequate to cover projected costs or projected expenses. Could you tell us specifically what the roll-up cost for 2009-11 biennium would be, first for the collective bargaining package and second for the governor's supplementary compensation package?
Madam Co-Chair and Senator Whitsitt, I actually do not have those numbers here in front of me. I will have them when we make our recommendations for the distribution of the dollars. I apologize. I just didn't bring that with me today.
Perhaps you could forward that to Senator Whitsitt in advance, it will be available.
Absolutely.
Great. Senator Berger.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I have a process question, and maybe I'm the only one that this seems to impact this way. This has the feeling that's very typical of the every 2 year legislative meetings. This is the kind of process that we have. But we've just had a session in February. And I'm just wondering if we were to go to annual sessions, if this process might not change. We could decide to change it, Senator, collectively, but I don't know that there's an automatic answer to how we would decide to operate.
In other words, well, let me be a little bit more specific. Talking about November, and Mr. Hill has said that that might have been done in February, but that there was a lot of ifs and ands about what was going to happen because of the April being a volatile month. So I'm just thinking ahead that if we keep this same process, that might be something that would be same song, 10th verse, because we're always going to have the volatile April, and then we would always be coming with the same kind of process, and then decisions that might be made in the early spring would be could be undone by an e-board later in the summer. It's just I just want to bring that and put it on the table. It just strikes me as something that's going to have to be thought through a little better if we change the times that we meet and what we do at the time.
And I think, Senator, that's the important point, that if the legislature chooses to establish, and actually if the voters choose, because we don't get to do that on our own, but if the voters choose to establish annual sessions, some very careful thoughts should go into the timing of those, because particularly if one of the purposes is to respond to budget adjustments, then we need to take into account the volatility questions on the availability of the information when we choose to come in. Good point. Very good point. Mr. Hill, are you finished? Or? Oh, Representative Hannah.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Darren, I think this point was brought up earlier. Representative Galizio brought it up. But so if we were to look at the document that was prepared at your request, for instance, by Department of Corrections, the document shows what happens if you give 50% of the $125 million that's out there that's appropriated to that agency versus none. Is that correct? That is correct. Okay, follow up then.
Let me clarify one thing. That money has not yet been appropriated to any agency. The action that the legislature took was to establish a special purpose appropriation allocated to the e-board. So agencies may think that they are entitled to a share of it, but the legislature has not taken an action yet to distribute those funds.
Follow up then? Thank you for that clarification. Yeah. I'll kind of restate the question then. The agency made an estimation of what their potential allocation would have been of the $125 million. Is that correct?
That is correct. Actually, just as a total clarification, Budget and Management actually sent out what the estimated proportion of that be, yes.
Okay, just so I want to be clear. I want everybody to understand. So the agency didn't pick the amount. Budget and Management said of the $125 million, if the legislature allocated your share of that money, X is what it would be.
That is correct.
And then an estimation was done on this of what happens if you get nothing, page 2, what happens if you get 50% of that, page 1.
Madam Chair,
we have that correct. Okay. So what about the option, and I think Representative Galizio brought it up, of what happens if you get your entire allocation? In other words, I mean, I think this is the first time most of us have seen this documentation.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, you know, when you start to read the details here and you see the Department of Corrections talking about closing 5 prisons, or on the next page, closing 8 prisons, I mean, I think that's headline news. It's pretty big stuff. And I don't know. I'd like to see what happens if they get their allocation. So I would just like to suggest here that
we get that option. And to the co-chairs, I would say, let's see what that option is, because despite me personally liking your plan for our future, looking at the budget and looking at the budget for 9/11, in my mind, you could scratch that whole list until we now know what this looks like. I mean, this becomes a little bit more drastic than I believe most of us thought. And I'd just like to see the number. If you've got the spreadsheet for 50%, you ought to be able to create it with what the payment looks like if we acted and they got 100% of their allocation.
Well, and I think that actually is a very good point, because there may be an assumption that should the E-Board choose to distribute proportionally the entire salary reserve, that everything would be hunky-dory. And I think part of what is showing here, sort of by innuendo almost, is maybe that's not true in some of the agencies.
I'm not sure if I might. I think that's glaringly apparent in that you're talking about $125 million total. Here's one agency that's 50 plus million of that would be still a shortfall. I mean, I'm doing some pretty rough math here, but...
Mr. Wilson has spent a lot of time working with the Department of Corrections, particularly on that very question. Maybe you can help edify this information.
Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, Doug Wilson of the Legislative Fiscal Office. First of all, keep in mind these numbers are, I'll say, 2 months old, roughly, in terms of what the agencies used. Expenditures vary significantly over from 1 month to another, so every time you update a monthly set of actuals, the numbers have changed, and that's actually what's happened with corrections. I don't think if they filled that out today, the numbers would be slightly different. That said, corrections does have limitations on what they can do. First of all, it would take legislative action, and in some cases, changes to the... I got to be careful here. Probably not change the Constitution, but significant legislative actions to take the actions on closing of prisons because of the way the sentencing laws are structured and their ability to release inmates. That said, I think that if there was a 0% allocation, you would have significant issues with the Department of Corrections, and you would be revisiting most likely what they could do. At 50%, it gets easier to fill the gap, but it is still very difficult. If it was 100%, based on the numbers that I've been working with them in this week, it breaks even and just a little bit to the positive, because they have taken actions, and this is important to say for the Department of Corrections, to hold back, partially in anticipation of, you know, whether or not they get 100% of the salary pot, or because of other issues they have within their budget around medical care, overtime, and a number of other issues. They have cut back already and held back funding from spending to make sure they cover their holes and try to be responsible. So, and I think they've been very successful at that. But given where they stand today, based on numbers, the most recent budget information they have, if they got 100%, they would be fine. If they got 50%, they would still have significant issues they'd have to deal with.
Senator Schrader?
Yeah, I think the question is good. Let's get 100% thing out there for everyone to chew on. And the reason we're bringing this up is so we can have some ways and means input prior to the E-Board. Now, we're not going to have another meeting, but you can easily get your information to Rocco and Insta us so that those of us that are on E-Board can inform. So this is an open process here. The other piece I mentioned, particularly the DOC, is I want everyone to make sure they look at the note at the bottom of that page. I mean, this is ways and means. There are ways to save money without having just to spend money, and that also is as good as spending money. And so I think the picture isn't as gloomy, perhaps, as, you know, we're the first to hear. And then these are just, you know, again, we're trying to be proactive here rather than wait to see what happens at the end. We're encouraging all the members here and the emergency board to think about different options, scenarios. This is all done pre-forecast. Forecast is better, sort of. You know, one person made it better. But the good news I see is that the agencies already have found, it looks like, almost $20 million in potential savings that don't affect salaries or wages or hiring or anything like that with, you know, the regular savings. If I look at that line, line 8, and if I look at the services and supplies savings line 11, so that's obviously $20 million that we don't have to spend, and we can help agencies like the Department of Corrections that are obviously, and we knew that coming into the interim, that the Department of Corrections was going to be in tough shape, so we can help them by being smart about how we allocate the money.
Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I'm just trying to get, I think, back up to the 50,000-foot level here for my own personal clarity. What I understand is that there is $125 million currently in a special purpose appropriation built into the budget. Is that correct? And how does that factor into the funding that the, is that part of the ending balance, or is that part of the e-fund? That's something that's actually built into the budget process right now. Okay, so that money is sitting there. Then what I understand from this document that we've just been going over, in order to totally fund the additional increases that the governor gave to management service employees, that brings the total bill to $130.6 million in general fund. So am I correct in assuming that what we've got here to fully fund this package is a $5.6 million general fund shortfall?
Madam Chair, Representative Morgan, just as a point of clarification, the 130.6 covers all of the compensation except for the management supplemental package, and it covers and the pension obligation bonds and the PERS rate. So
I can't hear you. Can you speak a little louder?
Oh, I'm sorry. The 130.6 covers all of the compensation except for the management supplemental package and the PERS rate change and the pension obligation piece. It does, that 130.6 does not include the management supplemental piece, and that's an additional almost $16 million.
General fund. Okay, so what the shortfall is then above the $125 million special purpose appropriation is $21.6 million, is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Morgan, yes, to cover everything, including the supplemental management increases, yes, that is correct.
Okay, and what... After the May revenue forecast, is the amount of the ending balance?
Madam Chair, it's $143 million general fund ending balance, of which roughly $140 million is dedicated to the rainy day fund.
You may have a follow-up?
Yes.
Very important. What does dedicated mean?
A law was passed. One of the components of the Rainy Day Fund law that was passed says that after the close of a biennium, 1% of the biennial expenditures are to be taken from that biennium's ending balance and be deposited into the Rainy Day Fund. And right now our general fund expenditures are roughly $14 billion, so roughly $140 million is supposed to be deposited into the Rainy Day Fund at the close of the 0709 biennium if the ending balance has that much in it. And if it has less than that, then the entire amount of the ending balance is to be deposited into the Rainy Day Fund.
Clarification,
yes, ma'am.
I recall that the language was up to 1%, that there was a discretionary aspect?
It's not discretionary. It's if there's less than that in the entire amount, the up to is not. It says 1%. If it's less than 1% in the ending balance, then the entire amount of the ending balance goes into the rainy day.
Okay, thank you. May I have one follow-up?
Representative.
So am I also correct in assuming that the salary increases that the governor has negotiated actually go into being whether or not we fund them? Is that correct? That the increases actually take place?
Madam Chair, Representative Warren, yes. The employees get the pay increases whether or not the salary special purpose appropriation is distributed. That they are not connected in that way. This is supplemental funding to agencies to pay for those increases, but it does not affect the employees whether they get the raises or not, because they will get them because it was a collective bargain.
Can I clarify on that one? Has the executive branch taken official action to implement the second step, additional top-end step for July 1, 2008? Or is that still to be implemented?
Madam Chair, I believe the governor's order was that that was going to take effect. It hasn't yet because it hasn't occurred yet, but right now the system indicates that it will take effect unless the governor says in a new order says that no, that's being taken back. But right now the plan is on July 1, 08, all management service classifications, salary range 24 and above, will lose the bottom step and add a top step, another top step, which means anyone who's at the current top step is eligible for an additional step at their next salary eligibility date.
Are you done?
One more follow-up, Representative. So is it a true statement then that if we do not fully fund this salary package, the net result to the citizens of Oregon is that they're going to receive less government services because more of this revenue is going to go to fund salary packages, so less of it will be available to fund programs or fund positions that would be providing services?
Madam Chair, Representative Morgan, I think in the normal course of executing a budget, all agencies encounter savings. And we would have to look more closely on a case-by-case basis of which agencies would not be able to continue delivering services at the legislatively approved level. I would suspect those agencies would come back to the emergency board with a request for additional funding. As the material that Mr. Hill provided you indicates, we still have $30 million in the general purpose emergency fund.
Mm-hmm.
So we would suspect that at some future date after the salary special purpose appropriation is allocated, that an agency that had a problem would come back and request funding from that general purpose money to supplement their budgets if they were unable to absorb any costs. And at that time, we would look at their ability to generate savings in their budgets. We always factor in a vacancy savings when we develop agency budgets, but we know that that's a very rough calculation, and some agencies incur more turnover than anticipated, and just by the nature of people leaving for other jobs, there are savings occurred because of vacancies. That's the primary way agencies have savings while executing their budget.
May I just...
Sure.
Around vacancy savings, I think that one of the continuing challenges of budgeting in the state has been to identify and weed out those that are genuinely vacancies and things that are being held vacant for purposes of reallocating the funding that's associated with them. And that that is going to continue to be an ongoing thing, and that part of the consequence of not fully funding the salary package is going to be to create a bunch more of that. So, you know, there's that aspect to it. The other question that I have is that on the outstanding issues here, I noticed that a number of the issues that are listed on this are things that we have, as a matter of course, often pushed into discussions in the next biennium, if that suited our purposes. And so I would just caution the committee here that when you look at that list of things, that those are not necessarily things that all need to be dealt with in this biennium.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I want to explore for a moment the consequences of appropriating the entire supplemental appropriation. So is it my understanding that there'll be approximately $30 million left to the E-Board for the remainder of the biennium?
Madam Co-Chair, Representative Edwards, there's a $30 million general purpose appropriation to the E-Board to cover other items, yes.
And so given the volatility of the current revenue forecast, would you consider that adequate?
Madam Co-Chair, Representative Edwards, that is for the co-chairs to decide. That is not for me.
Well, I suppose in my considered opinion, I would regard it as inadequate. And so I think that I would urge my colleagues to exercise caution. Unfortunately, we're in a position akin to a character, one of Kafka's short stories, where a character is chained by the neck between two rocks, and moving towards one rock raises the specter of strangulation by the other. So hopefully we can come to some reasonable compromise, but clearly I think that we're in a position where, given the volatility of the revenue forecast and the inadequate resources that would be available to the E-Board, if we should extend the entire amount, we should consider some interim step.
Thank you. Senator Galizia, Representative Galizia.
Thank you. I'm not going to quote an existential author in my remarks, but I would also say that I don't know that any LFO analyst can quantify uncertainty. In other words, in this state, we have tremendous uncertainty. We have questions that are actually not unique to this session, fires, the fire season, etc. One thing is certain that we're doing, the longer we wait, is we're increasing the uncertainty. That is certain. And so I don't know, can you ever quantify uncertainty in terms of what that costs for agencies in terms of what they're doing? What does that cost them?
Madam Co-Chair, Representative Galizio. Obviously, we can't quantify it down to a certain dollar amount. But do keep in mind that this is a portion of an agency's personal services budget. And that as a percentage of total personal services, any portion that you give them of this is again, just a small portion of their total biennial personal services costs. So, as we pointed out earlier, yes, the longer you wait, the more uncertainty they have, the more likely our agencies are to take actions to make sure that if the worst-case scenario occurs, that they're prepared for that. But again, on the other side of that, to remember that this is a small portion, percentage-wise, of the total personal services budget.
Follow-up, Representative? Okay. Anybody else? Senator Johnson.
Thank you. Going back to your outstanding issues, taking a page out of Senator Whitsitt's book and having personally sat through a meeting over at the Association of Oregon Counties and listening to the discussion about the possibility, if not probability, of some Oregon counties declaring insolvency with the failure to reauthorize Public Law 106393, I would submit that that might belong on your list of of unresolved potential funding problems. I think we're in a place where we haven't been before discussing the insolvency, potential insolvency of counties, and having sat through a very sobering presentation about what effect that might have, particularly in the public's safety arena, I would offer for your consideration that you would add that as an outstanding issue.
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, good point.
Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you, Commissioner Nolan. Comment. I mean, I would be very hard pressed to support 100% distribution of these compensation packages. Certainly, until we find out what the roll-up cost for the next biennium would be, precisely what effect it would have on our ending balance. And also, I'm really somewhat amazed that the lack of a salary increase could essentially, according to these papers, stagnate or almost stop state government. And certainly the Corrections Department said it would, from a quick review, would say that it would essentially shut them down. In the private sector, when you run into a revenue shortfall, you try not to lay off people, but you certainly don't increase their salaries until you have money to pay them. You certainly don't lay off everybody on a across the board. You, in the private sector, we certainly have key employees and key priorities, and rather than go with an essential budget level, which I have always thought has been an oxymoronic, I mean, that means to me that everything that we do in government has equal priority, and I do not believe that, and it's going to take some convincing for me to be taught that. So I believe that we need to look at this very closely, and at this point in time, I certainly would not be able to, if we were voting today, I would not be able to support, with the knowledge that we have, with the information we've been given, I would not be able to support the release of virtually any of this money at this point until we know more about the outcomes.
Thank you, Senator. Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Madam Clerk. Some pretty sobering news for us as we're looking through this, I think, and certainly some reason to be extremely cautious as we make decisions. I've got to understand a little bit here. If the salary ranges or if the salaries, if we're unable to meet that, we run out of money, sort of thing, then some reductions are somewhere are going to be necessary. And appreciating that what you said, that there's only a very small portion maybe of some agency budget, but a question of what type of flexibility is available in the other portions of agency budgets. A debt load, for example, might be one other thing which is not going to be something that we can make reductions in very easily unless you can find cheaper bonds to refinance with, type of thing. But it kind of gets to, it kind of then comes down, it looks to me like, Madam Co-Chair, to a matter that you're going to have to, some way or another cut services. Well, in the case of corrections, that's sometimes hard to do because we've got some statutory and maybe constitutional issues that we have to deal with it. So if I'm correct, one of the historical ways that we've dealt with it is to have unfilled positions, which gives us some types of cushions with this. But my question is, do you have some kind of an assessment, some type of an evaluation of what the difference is between having to pay the overtime to people in order to keep those operations going versus having the full-time positions there. And I think Department of Corrections, along with the Department of Human Services and the mental health area and some others, you know, fall into, you know, a lot of that having to use overtime as a way to fill in their staffing. And I would like to know, before we get to having to make some of these decisions, whether or not there is actually significant savings there. I mean, there's significant more risks there as far as the individual, as far as patients or clients or prisoners or whatever category. But that's another question. The one I'm interested in right now is, do you have any figures or do we have any ability to project what types of savings there are there if we get down to having to go that route?
Madam Chair, Representative Jensen, if I could first point of clarification. I didn't want to somehow say that this is such a small portion that agencies could just eat it. I guess my point was is that in executing a budget, the portion is a small enough amount where agencies probably aren't going to be having to take huge dramatic actions right away if they don't get the money right away, but they do will start taking actions if they don't get the money right away because they've got a plan for the worst case scenario. So I guess I didn't want to intimate somehow that this was such a small portion. To answer your question, yes. The analysis, and as I mentioned before, what we did here was we just asked agencies to please give us the best information they could. And given the time frames, I think they did a good job with that. What we would like to do now is get some sense, and before we make our actual recommendations, we will be looking at those large general fund agencies and the ones that you mentioned in particular, and looking at those things. As they propose having layoffs and or keeping positions vacant, yes, obviously the cash is going to flow out the door if they have to pay overtime. So we will be doing those kind of analyses before we make a recommendation.
Madam Co-Chair, on this, I would certainly, before we get to that point, I realize that we're not there today. We're trying to figure out what our problems are going to be when we do get, you know, there. But I certainly
that's
would
approaching
like
the end of the month.
Yeah, I certainly would like to have that information. I think it would be beneficial for us. I don't know how it's going to come out, but I'd like to have the information.
I think LFO and the Office of Budget and Management is scratching pretty hard down into that. Representative Hanna?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. And I want to get a point of clarification so that we all understand this, or maybe it's just me. $143 million is the ending fund balance. $125 million, I believe, is that special appropriation balance that was for salaries. The $125 is not included in the $143. Is that correct?
Mr. Ruffer?
Ma'am Chair Ripson Hanna, it is not. The 143 is ending balance. The $125 million has already been appropriated to the emergency board for these purposes. So it's within the emergency fund.
Okay, thank you. A point of clarification?
One more clarification on that. In terms of current authority available to the e-board, the e-board does not have authority over the $143 million. The e-board on its own cannot do anything with that money. It cannot spend it. That would take a convening of an emergency session of the legislature. The e-board has authority over the $30 million e-fund that the legislature appropriated to it and the $125 million special appropriation and a few other small special purpose appropriations, but that's it.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, and I appreciate that. My further question about that is, so that we understand those are separate pools of money,
yes.
Is that because there was some discussion around whether or not to allocate that special appropriation money, if the money is not allocated and there is a balance when the biennium ends, does that not revert back to the ending fund balance? And if it does revert to the ending fund balance, depending on what that total balance would be, if you don't allocate it, it's going to end up in the rainy day fund. Am I doing the math right here?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, yes. Anything left in the emergency fund reverts at the end of the biennium to as as if you would appropriate money to an agency and they ended up not spending it, that reverts just like the emergency fund reverts.
So one more comment to that. So I think this is important because though I will not be serving on e-board, many of you will, and this decision specific to the $125 million becomes appropriate where you can and have statutory authority to make that decision, you're going to be looking forward saying, how much of it do we allocate? But if we don't allocate it and it goes, reverts to the ending fund balance, it's all going to go over into the rainy day fund. At any rate, it doesn't move to the next biennium, I don't think.
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, it depends on what the ending balance is. Right now, if nothing changed between now and the end of the biennium, it would be, since the ending balance is greater than 1% of expenditures, that money would then be available as a beginning balance for the 09-11 biennium.
If nothing changes in the actual revenue collections over the next 13 months.
Correct, yes.
Thank you. And Mr. Rocco, you did a good job of describing that earlier, and I'm not going to try to go through the math, but I think the point is, and I hope as the presentation is made by the co-chairs and legislative fiscal, when you get to the point of making that decision, that is if, that's a big if nothing changes. If something does change and that appropriation is not made, potentially it could all end up in the rainy day fund rather than paying back to salaries. And my entire point about all of that is, first of all, understand the complication with how those dollars flow. And secondly, it goes to Representative Morgan's point that when you look at these, say, the what happens if you pay nothing, and when you look at if you pay 50%, and potentially if we saw the 100%, I think the word that I think is best put here, intentionally holding positions vacant, is a significant piece of savings. And intentionally holding positions vacant are people that are not hired to do the job that that agency is supposed to be doing and providing the service to Oregonians. I say all that to be careful, that's all, and to watch the math, because you all are going to be making that decision and you're going to have to decide, if nothing happens, how much you want flowing versus how much you want paying for actual services.
Excellent points. Thank you. Any other discussion? Representative Morgan?
I think that there would be value for the committee to get some clarity around the issue with the rainy day fund and the balance carried forward and some of the hydraulics that are associated with this discussion. And I wonder if we could, if you would entertain asking Mr. Rocco to kind of elucidate on that in a briefing paper or something like that, so that we could get a little bit better handle on the dynamic of this.
Is that feasible?
Madam Chair, Representative Morgan, I'd be glad to do that.
Great. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Or I'd be glad to give it to somebody in the office.
Co-Chair Schrader.
Again, just to put this all in context, good discussion. I, as co-chair, appreciate it because I'm getting a sense of where members are and their touch points. Some of the savings stuff might be fine. Others, not so good. Might affect programs. This is very, very helpful, and hopefully including you as part of the process will give us better support for the legislature and our partners as we go down the road and try to prepare for the future. I'd rather have us deal with this than come up against a brick wall. All of a sudden, we're in a crisis. I don't want to come back, I don't think. I'm on the campus in a special session. In fact, I think it's our job to be thoughtful about this, not just the executive branch. I'd rather the legislature retain some control, so I appreciate everyone's input.
Good. Representative Shields.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Looking at these numbers, $52 million for Department of Corrections, $30 million for OUS, $28 million for DHS, there's nothing that says we have to do 75% of everybody's request, right? We can try to piece together our own priorities of where we think the funds should be allocated.
Mr. Rocker?
Madam Chair, Representative Shields, That is correct. In fact, one of the things we have been considering with at the upper level of that four scenario thing at a 75% level, just for an example, that would allow an across-the-board allocation of 75%. The remaining amount in the salary special purpose appropriation then at a later meeting after we get the September forecast, for example, that money then could be allocated by the emergency board to any agency that demonstrated a special need. If the Department of Corrections can demonstrate to us that if it was a 75% allocation was not sufficient, at that time that balance, you know, roughly 25 million or so, whatever, roughly it's 26.8 or something, could be used to supplement any agency's situation if they could demonstrate a need. If the Department of Human Services could show a need for it, then it could be used for them. And that's part of the thought process that we've been going through, is trying to buy a little more time for the problem areas of state government so we get another forecast under our belts to see where things are, but not hamper agencies by giving out nothing, because as Darren was saying, agencies have to implement plans if that occurs, because they have to start taking actions now. And so we just, it's a balanced situation we're looking at. It's a difficult thing, but we're trying to give, retain some flexibility with the emergency board to deal with issues of a statewide concern, but yet let agencies have some semblance of continuing with their ongoing regular program activity.
Finding that exact balance point is our collective challenge, ladies and gentlemen. Follow up? Are we done? Very good discussion. I would echo Senator Schrader's points that this is very informative, both in a sense of the committee's interest in continuing services, but also being very mindful of the impact that that has on our ability to address unknown emergencies that may come up in the remaining 12 months, and also to position ourselves prudently for the 2009-11 legislative budget, as Senator Whitsitt had pointed out. So you've given us a lot of food for thought. You've also given LFO some requests for information that will be followed up on, and I appreciate the discussion. We have no further business, so we are adjourned.